From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Following protests, a local film school removes Birth of a Nation movie posters from its hallways. Then author and comedian Andy Borowitz adapts his satirical news column into a stand-up routine, but he doesn't just want people to laugh.
My goal with this show is to make people take action. People have told me this show gave me so much hope. And I said, well, that was the opposite of my intention. I was trying to terrify you.
And many women have postpartum depression. Most don't do stand-up comedy about it, but Angelina Spicer does. All that coming up on The Frame. In the history of cinema, The Birth of a Nation is considered a landmark of technical achievement, and D.W. Griffith's 1915 movie, with its heroic depiction of the Ku Klux Klan, is also an enduring symbol of racism. A vintage poster and an advertising flyer from The Birth of a Nation have been on display inside the Dodge Film School at Chapman University in Orange County, but now, following student protests and a faculty vote, Chapman has removed the Birth of a Nation artifacts. Jill Replicle is KPCC's Orange County reporter, and she was on the Chapman campus today. She joins us on the line now. So, Jill, let's talk first about the posters. What do they look like, and where were they located?
Sure. So the main one is a pretty big poster, about 3 feet high, advertising the film to be shown at the Ford Theater in Baltimore. It's a really plain poster, just the name of the film, nothing else. And then next to it is a framed newspaper advertisement about the film, also from that time. And I should say, I've only seen photos of both because they were taken down almost immediately following the faculty vote yesterday afternoon. So now there's just a blank space on the wall. And the spot is kind of in the back hallway that leads to a production studio. It seemed like not a very prominent part of the building, but students told me that they walk by there all the time and that prospective students walk by there on tours of the building.
Can you talk a little bit about the effort to get the posters taken down? Where did it begin and what were the students' concerns?
It's something that some students have been asking for a long time. I talked to one student, Jay Staten. He's a junior. He's one of just a handful of Black students studying film production at Chapman. And he told me he first emailed faculty in December 2017 to express his discomfort with the posters.
It's a reminder that this thing brought back the KKK. It's a reminder that the white people in it use blackface. It's just, for me, it just reminds me of all of those racist atmosphere that I'm trying to, in a way, ignore or pivot my mindset of so I can pursue my education and not feel insecure.
And he said he had a conversation with some faculty members at the time about it, but ultimately nothing was done. And then, you know, the calls have been getting louder from more students in recent years upset about the posters. And then finally, a protest was held last week with at least 150 students, according to The Panther, that's the student newspaper. And school leaders decided to hold a faculty vote on the matter. And yesterday, the faculty voted to take the posters down. Staten, the student that we heard from, said he's thrilled that they were finally taken down and really just happy that the student community rallied around the cause and ultimately that faculty supported them.
You said that this protest dates back to 2017. What has the response been from the university and how has their response evolved?
Well, the president wrote an op-ed recently and said he understood the concerns with the film itself, but he, you know, talked about the film's place in history and some of the techniques that were very avant-garde at the time that were used and felt like it was something that needed to be part of visual history. And he basically said that he wasn't going to take them down.
And then the president decided that if the faculty voted to take them down, he would follow the faculty's recommendations. And they had a couple of options. Is that right?
Right. So the options were to take it down or to keep it up, but add a plaque, putting it into context and explaining why it was on the wall, why they had decided to keep it up there.
I talked with a Chapman faculty member who joined the protest. His name is Ron McCants. He's a professor and a TV writer. And this is why he told us he wanted to join the students.
Well, I realized that the kids were hurting, the students, you know, and they're not all, you know, one color either, right? And I think I'm one of two or one of three Black faculty members in Dodge College. And so I know that I'm one of very few. So my voice is extremely important. Right, especially if I know how to navigate academia.
So what is the demographic makeup of Chapman?
It's predominantly white. The most recent freshman class is just over 50% white. Black students make up just 1.6% of that class. And it's a small school, so that's just 30 people.
You talked to some other students today. What were their reactions to the decisions to remove the artwork?
One student told me he understood why it was up in the first place, because it was such a monumental work in film history. But he said he's still glad it was taken down. It was a good decision. Another woman told me that it was about time. She had seen potential students of color and their families lingering in front of the poster during tours and could tell that it was something that made them very uncomfortable and possibly even discouraged some of them from choosing Chapman.
Orange is predominantly white. Dodge is very white. And so, you know, we're trying to diversify, and it's going to be hard to do that if people come in and that's the first thing they see, because it's a little discouraging.
And that was Hannah Freeman. She's a senior in television writing and production.
Finally, here's what Professor McCants told us about what it means to him that the Birth of a Nation artifacts have been removed.
It says that speaking up matters, change matters. And I think what this shows is that the administration, the faculty, listened to what the students had to say and recognized that there was an issue and there was a need for change, right? And the fact that change did happen shows that there's ample opportunity and hope for the future. And so I feel hopeful, you know, that this is one step towards a more inclusive university, that, you know, students of color will be proud to attend, but also demonstrate a love for their school.
I know the artwork just came down, but has there been any talk of what, if anything, might replace them on the walls?
A couple of women told me the rumor is that a poster of Casablanca is going to replace it, but as far as I know, that's just a rumor.
I'm going to make another suggestion. I think they should put up a poster for Spike Lee's Black Klansman. Jill Replicle is KPCC's Orange County correspondent. Jill, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Coming up, Andy Borowitz writes the Borowitz Report humor column for The New Yorker that often pokes fun at Donald Trump. Borowitz is now on a stand-up comedy tour, and he explains why satirizing the leader of the free world is a whole lot harder than you might imagine. Now author and comedian Andy Borowitz. He writes the Borowitz Report that you can find in The New Yorker. For those who don't know, it's a satirical news column. For example, a headline last week read, "Putin almost done redacting Mueller report." Before writing for The New Yorker, Borowitz worked in television. He co-created the NBC sitcom, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Now, Borowitz is on a stand-up comedy tour. He calls it the Make America Not Embarrassing Again tour. When I sat down with Borowitz, we started with the challenge of bringing his satirical writing to the microphone.
It's totally different. It's not natural. I would never say that anything I do comes naturally. It comes as a result of tremendous effort and anxiety. But what happened here, just to, in a nutshell, is that some producers approached me and said, "We'd like to send you out on the road because you've been writing this column and people are interested in that." And I realized after committing to this that I did not have an act. So that hampers
a performer.
That's
kind of a requirement for a comedian or
anybody. What I found was I thought I was originally going to start doing a bunch of Trump jokes, and I would disparage Trump in many ways. And don't be disappointed. That is still very much a part of the show. I could never get through a show called Make America Not Embarrassing Again without addressing that. But the show grew, and I found myself asking a lot of questions about how we got to this place. And that, to me, became more interesting because I think the problems that we have in the country far exceed just this one orange individual.
Your material is often very closely tied to what's happening in a given day, given hour. So when you're thinking about jokes that might need updating or material that might need to come in, how open are you to the idea that you have to be current, or do you have to, at a certain point, lock it down and say, this is going to be the show regardless of what happens in the next week or two?
That's a really good question, and I've sort of solved that problem to the extent that I'm capable of solving any problem. And the show is a mix. About an hour of it is rehearsed. I have done it around the country for about a year. So that process allows you to refine and figure out, okay, this works, this chunk works, this doesn't work. But about a half an hour of the show is totally improvised. I take questions from the audience, and invariably, people will raise questions about something that happened that day. So it's usually something I haven't thought about. And I find that the energy I get from the audience and the sheer panic that goes through me when a question I haven't anticipated is thrown at me actually sometimes generates interesting results, and results that I couldn't have gotten if I were sitting at home alone trying to write something.
I want to play a clip from something you did at, well, you say where it is at the start. So let's listen to this clip of something you did not that long ago.
We are here tonight at the New York Society for Ethical Culture to talk about Donald Trump, which, by the way, is the first time Donald Trump has been used in the same sentence as ethical. True. Or culture. Or society. We just keep going. Just keep going.
I think it's easy for some people to assume that making fun of Donald Trump is easy, but I suspect it's actually a lot harder than dealing with, say, George W. Bush or Hillary Clinton. And I'm wondering how you see it.
Well, you're very perceptive. It's actually harder. People find that impossible to believe. The guy who does the newsletter for the Borowitz Report, when I write a story, he said, I was reading this thing that Donald Trump said, and I was sure it showed up on my Facebook feed. I was sure it was something you wrote. And I said, what was it? And it was, in fact, Donald Trump wondering, and this is a true story, why George Washington named his home Mount Vernon. Why didn't he put his name in the house? Because Donald Trump said, that's what I would have done. And it was so absurd, so childish, so narcissistic. It's the kind of thing that you could easily see somebody in my job resorting to as a fake news story. But in fact, as my newsletter editor said, Donald Trump once again has beaten you to the punchline. So it is it's an ongoing problem, John. Most people do say things like, what are you going to do when Trump's out of office? He's been such a gift to comedy. But really, you must believe me that the opposite is true.
We're talking with Andy Borowitz from the Borowitz Report for The New Yorker. He's doing a stand-up show at the Dolby Theater on April 24th. I want to read you two headlines. One is from one of your columns in The New Yorker. One is from The Onion. I think you can guess which one is which, but maybe our listeners won't know. Number one, Trump vows extensive search to find new DHS director with ideal personality disorders.
That's and good. That's The Onion.
Two, Trump names Lori Loughlin education secretary.
Yep, that's me. And but, I should also quote an earlier column I did, which is in the Lori Loughlin genre, which was in late 2016, I had him naming El Chapo to run the DEA. So this is a trope at this point, or a meme, which is who will Trump name for a new position, the least appropriate person. Actually, a few days before that Onion piece came out, I took the low road and said that he was going to name Ted Nugent to head DHS. And that seems like kind of the same joke as The Onion, except maybe a little stupider.
Do you ever worry that you have this idea, I wonder if it's unique enough, if other people might have the same take on something that I'm going to report on and write a story about?
You know, I always check. I do check before I write something to make sure that somebody else hasn't done the exact same thing. And a lot of times I will think I've struck on something that no one else could have thought of. And, you know, it turns out that The Onion has done it, in which case I hang my head in sadness and and delete that story and then try to think of something new. But with every president, there becomes sort of a comedy meme version of that president. George W. Bush was deemed a dunce who always used malprops and said stupid things.
There are certain liberal agitators out there who'd like you to believe that my administration's not doing such a good job. Of course, these are people such as Howard Stern, Richard Clark, and the news.
And so that became kind of the reflexive way of characterizing him. And in a sense, all these political figures, I mean, I used to work in sitcoms, and all these political figures become kind of like sitcom characters. And that really becomes a little bit of the job of writing political satire. You're commenting on a perceived image that each of these individuals has. And in Trump's case, we all seize upon his narcissism, his unfitness for office. And in that, we usually arrive at something resembling the truth, unfortunately.
Last year at the New Yorker Festival, you did a live interview with Adam Schiff. He represents Pasadena. It's also my congressman. I want to listen to a compliment that he gave you.
It's a treat to be here with you when your email pops up in my inbox. It's the only good news of the day, almost every day for me, and I want to thank you for that. If you weren't making us laugh, we'd all go mad.
Well, thank you.
And that raised in my mind a broader question about satire. And I think if you think about great satirists, they are able to incorporate real events, real people, and tell fictional stories that get at some larger truth. How do you place what you do in the broader idea of what satire is supposed to illuminate?
My goal with this show is to make people take action. I'm not really interested in making people feel better. People have told me after the show, they've said, "This show gave me so much hope." And I said, "Well, that was the opposite of my intention. I was trying to terrify you. How have I failed?" I would hate to feel like I was just sending people to sleep on a cloud of liberal happiness, because that's not my goal. But I have a fairly old-fashioned view of what satire is supposed to do. I don't think I always succeed. But I think the key to me, and this is, I think now there is a broader definition that a lot of people seize upon when they do what they call satire, which is we're just making fun of people. We're just taking like public figures and we're eviscerating them. And actually that to me seems more like burlesque or a lampoon, you know, where you're just taking a character and you're exaggerating his or her qualities and making fun of them. To me, the whole point of satire is you've got to find a target that is worth taking down. I don't believe in punching down. I think there's a lot of comedy now that punches down, and I believe in punching up. And that is, I will admit, extremely old-fashioned. I put myself squarely in the Jonathan Swift school. You can, you know, just ship me back to the 18th century where I belong. And that's my view. I think that there's the first goal is always to make people laugh, but for it to be satire, in my book, it should be attempting to criticize something that deserves it.
Andy Borowitz is the author of the Borowitz Report for The New Yorker. He'll be playing at the Dolby Theater on April 24th. Andy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Coming up on The Frame, when you think of material for a stand-up act, could postpartum depression be funny? One comedian said, why not? Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. One in seven women who give birth to a child have postpartum depression, and most find it very hard to discuss, but not LA comedian Angelina Spicer, who talks about it a lot in her stand-up routine. KPCC's early childhood reporter Priska Neely has her story.
Put your hands together for Angelina Spicer!
I am Angelina Spicer. I am a comedian, an influencer, and accidental activist. Yeah.
That last thing, accidental activist, that's new and unexpected.
I didn't plan on this journey. It chose me, for sure. I never would have thought that I'd be, like, telling moms to advocate for themselves.
And she's lobbying on their behalf, too. She's testified about her experience with postpartum depression before lawmakers in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. She talks about it at hospitals and conferences. And she's speaking about her trauma on stage, something she never did before she became a mom.
I'm not one of those people that thrives on pain or tragedy to find my material. You know, I'm an outspoken Black woman. My husband is very straight-laced white guy. Like, there's enough there.
Before she became this accidental activist, Spicer was known for things like her spoofs of Tyra Banks on America's Next Top Model.
Your photo was nothing short of brilliant.
Parodies of progressive commercials where she plays a Black Flo.
White privilege for everyone. Now that's progressive.
And satirical remixes of hit songs.
My style before, in hindsight, was very superficial, but it was funny.
Now, Spicer is drawing from a much deeper well, and on stage, she keeps it really real.
After you have a baby, people will tell you that your vagina just breaks. Right, she's shaking her head. Yes, girl, it breaks, it falls apart.
Her evolution as a comedian began back when she and her husband got pregnant. She says she was happy and hopeful, but when her daughter, Ava, was born, she faced a new reality.
I thought that pushing the baby out was going to be the hardest part. I was like preparing, like, okay, got to do my yoga, got to get the epidural, but I was not expecting what followed.
She says everything about caring for her new daughter was just hard and scary, and she was still shooting a web series and doing stand-up. She tried out some jokes about her new motherhood, and it didn't work.
I'm like, girl, time plus tragedy. You got to give it some time before you just jump out there. But I was out there, and I heard crickets.
Like many new moms, Spicer was struggling with stress and sleep. Her husband, Joe Trigilio, says she kept most of it inside.
She looked like she was holding it together. She looks like she was doing it. And I think me and her mom both saw it. We saw that she was, you know, stressed, more stressed than usual. But overall, I mean, you couldn't tell.
At 8 months postpartum, that's when everything just crumbled.
Spicer was overwhelmed by intrusive, violent thoughts. She told her therapist about this.
So I was essentially apologizing to my therapist for what I had done in my mind. That's when my therapist was like, you need to go check into a hospital.
She spent 10 days getting care at a psychiatric hospital. This was 3 years ago, but she didn't talk about it on stage until just a few months ago.
Before it was, you know, the dragon uterus, the broken vag, all that. But like the deep, deep, deep hospital shame. It took a while. For me, this was so shameful. Going to a psychiatric hospital?
She talks about it now because she wants to remove that shame. And she wants people to know how she got to the other side.
My therapist took one look at me and she was like, girl, you need to go to a hospital. My first thought was, can I sleep there?
After her hospital stay, Spicer continued therapy. She started taking antidepressants. Her family pooled money to pay for childcare. And she learned how to cope and envision a future where her baby daughter grows up.
Like, I was so caught up in those anxious, depressed, never-ending moments that I couldn't imagine her even saying, uttering a word. I couldn't. I just thought her love language forever and ever and ever was going to be crying. And it's just a miracle now to see, like, she's a person.
We got fruit snacks.
You got fruit snacks? Yeah.
Yeah, look at a bumblebee. Mm-hmm. Bumblebee.
Ava is 3 now, and Angelina just loves being her mom.
Ava, do you remember when you were a baby?
Yeah.
You do? Tell me about what you remember.
I remember you with your tummy.
Uh-huh, you were in my tummy. And did we go on stage and do comedy when you were in my tummy?
Yeah.
You went to the comedy club with me?
Spicer said she didn't feel completely healed until Ava's 3rd birthday. Her husband says he's proud of her bravery in sharing her story.
She's embraced it and I think made a huge impact in a short time.
Her testimony helped to pass legislation in California requiring screenings and referrals for postpartum depression. And with each stand-up show she does, she starts a new conversation.
I hate that people lie about everything. Especially with kids, you know? They lie and tell you that you can't get postpartum depression. Yeah, I got that. I know it's a white girl's disease. I know. But I got it.
Spicer recognizes that with this subject matter, there's a delicate balance between being funny and being insensitive. She carefully walks that line, and her audiences love it.
the response I get is like the new Me Too movement. Like, oh, finally somebody said it.
She's raising money now to shoot a comedy special as part of a documentary she's making on maternal mental health. And she's even figured out a way to combine her new message about postpartum depression, or PPD, with her classic parody approach.
You down with PPD? Yeah, you know me. You down with PPD? Yeah, you
know me. You for The Frame, PPD? I'm Priska Neely.
Who's down with PPD? You down with PPD?
For more on Angelina Spicer and postpartum depression, check out Priska's story on LAist. That's LAIST.com. That's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Who's down with PPD? Yeah, you know me. Who's down with PPD?